order, and we will rejoin our... Pardon me, are we in a...
We're in a hearing.
Are we in a hearing? Okay. We'll rejoin our public hearing on Senate Bill 522, Arch Flack and Burton Weiss. Gentlemen, we're aware of the Senate vote here, and so if you would just give us a very brief rundown on this, we'd appreciate it.
None of us don't talk about it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack, and I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And what's being distributed to you is a letter from Rob Bovet, County Council in Lincoln County, in support of the bill. Actually, Mr. Weiss and I got involved in the Senate side and helped with a couple of amendments to make it what I'll call a good bill, good little bill that should pass. This is a process and procedure, and it actually helps local government as well as individual property owners who want to annex to special districts. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll, as Representative Sinceri said, I'll be quiet and not hinder the bill any longer. I answer questions if you'd like.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? All right. Thank you. Mr. Weiss, anything?
Burton Weiss, Special Districts Association. I'll need to say we support the bill and worked on it on the amendments on the Senate side.
All right. Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
I just want to make sure that this bill only impacts an individual landowner who wants to be annexed. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, that's exactly what it does. It affects an individual property owner who comes forward and wants to annex for service to a special district.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair.
Representative Beck.
This bill doesn't distinguish between certain size parcels. If someone owns 2,000 acres inside a city but or inside an urban boundary but they're not annexed, if they so wanted to annex, they could.
Mr. Chair,
why, I guess maybe be more pointed, why couldn't they or could they annex today? If not, why not, and how will this change?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, the controlling documents at this point are two, which are the criteria for review on approval, and that is the local comprehensive plan and the agreement, special agreement between the district and the governing body in terms of where services should be provided. It does not address the size of parcel, but basically the type of land use and the type of service to be provided.
I can follow up. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Now, we have some communities that have got this can't annex without a vote of the people sort of thing, right? Is that correct?
That's correct.
How would this...
Mr. Chair, Representative Beckett, does not affect that type of annexation to a city. This is only an annexation to a special district. If he wants to provide water to a water district or fire district is probably the two most likely that you'll see for fire services. It's not
even aiming to cut.
It's a different ballgame.
Bingo.
Thank you. Further questions? All right. Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 522, and we will open a work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On Senate Bill 522, Representative Stark.
I move Senate Bill 522 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Starr moves Senate Bill 522 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? All right. Seeing none, clerk, please.
Gaskin.
Aye.
Beck.
Aye.
Bowman.
Yes.
Deckard.
Yes.
Harper.
Aye.
Starr.
Aye.
Sinceri.
Yes.
Thompson.
Wilson. Aye. And the motion carries. And Representative Starr, would you carry that for us?
Absolutely.
Thank you. All right, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 522. For those who may have come in late, I want to mention again that House Bill 3502 has been pulled from today's schedule. We'll now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 586. And I'll have my sign-up sheet here in just a moment. Kara, would you talk about that bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Sean Chandler will explain the bill much better than I. Senate Bill 586 would allow land adjacent to an urban growth boundary to be removed from the boundary under certain conditions. There's a fiscal statement and a revenue statement at your places, FYI.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Chandler, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on Senate Bill 586. If you'll indulge me, let me explain what this bill does. It's a little on the complicated side unless you're a hardcore land use junkie. One of the issues that's plagued us in land use circles for a bunch of years has been the issue of what to do with farmland or land being farmed inside of urban growth boundaries. Under Oregon law, land inside of boundaries is presumed to be available for development. Therefore, it's farmed. It may be being farmed. It's not farmland in the EFU sense. Many of the farmers that are operating it don't see it that way. They see it as farmland. They intend to continue operating. From our standpoint, from the building side, that land is counted as though it's available for development as part of the buildable land's inventory. It's not considered a use like a factory would be or a housing project would be. It's considered open space. The local government is required by law to count it as though it's available for development when it may not be. Probably the most dramatic example of this conflict is in the metro area, where there's approximately 10,000 acres inside the metro UGB that are on farm use assessment. The Metro Council is talking about expanding the UGB about 10,000 acres, some of which is farmland. So we have this anomalous situation of potentially taking farmland outside the boundary in order to save farmland inside the boundary, or conversely, the potential sacrifice of farmland inside the boundary when perhaps it should not be. Prior to the 1997 session, a work group was put together of the builders, the nurserymen, the Farm Bureau, DLCD, Metro, cities, counties, and special districts. They brought a mediator in from out of state. We spent the better part of 6 months, regular meetings, came up with the bill that you see in front of you. We did not introduce it in the 1997 session because ballot measure 47 passed, ballot measure 50 was under discussion, and because this does deal with property tax recapture, which I'll get to here in a minute, it was simply the cities and counties didn't want to talk about the implications of this bill. We felt that under the circumstances it wasn't worth pushing. And so we did not. We brought the same bill, exactly the same bill, back to this session. What it does is basically four things. And by way of background, before I get to them, you may be aware, but I'll state just in case you're not. Anytime farmland, or land that's receiving farm use assessment, is converted out of that use to another use, higher and better use, urban development, for example, there is a recapture of the property taxes. The land is taxed currently at its farm value, even if it's in an industrial zone. Once it converts out, there's a recapture of taxes. There's a shorter time period for recapture inside of urban growth boundaries as a way of incentivizing farmland to convert over to urban use, but it's still a bit of a disincentive for the person holding that land to come out of farm production because they do have the tax burden. With that background, the bill does four things. First thing is it recognizes that there are some UGBs in the state where land was included when the urban growth boundaries were drawn. That was good farmland. It probably should not be in the boundary. It probably should be taken out of the boundary and allowed to continue in farm use without any urban pressure. Bill sets up a process for land that's adjacent to the boundary or one property in, assuming that both properties want to come out, to be taken out of the urban boundary and the line redrawn and the number of housing units or jobs or whatever the zoning was be made up someplace else, either through increased density or moving the boundary onto less productive land. That's the first thing the bill does. Second thing the bill does is if you have farmland inside the boundary that's within what we're calling in the bill an urban service area, which requires the local government, is voluntary, the local government does not have to do this, but the situation we're thinking about is land outside of a city limits, but basically in the county. It's outside the city, inside the urban growth boundary, undeveloped land. City designates, this is where the water lines are going to go, this is where the sewer lines are going to go, this is the direction we want to take our growth. Once they've made that designation and adopted the urban service area, any farmland or any land receiving farm use assessment within that area can convert to an urban use for a time period without the recapture as a way of increasing the incentive for the farmer to sell and have urban use occur on that farmland. The third thing the bill does, and the archetype we're thinking of here is for the Portlanders, Alpine Rose Dairy. There are properties within urban growth boundaries that are being farmed that are counted as though they're buildable, which shouldn't be. They should be off limits. They should be taken off the inventory. We don't have a system right now to do that. This bill will allow not just Alpine Rose, which is kind of an icon, but any farmland that chooses to do so to take open space designation, which is, and it's been a long time since I read the statute, to essentially declare themselves open space, take themselves off of the buildable lands inventory, agree with the governing body that for a period of 20 years, they won't develop the land. So it's off limits completely. The city or the county then or the city has to make up the density, the units that would have been built there someplace else, same way as if something had occurred there. But it allows a way for longer-term protection of farmland inside of urban growth boundaries than currently exists. And the fourth thing is it places some limitation on the ability to transfer land farmland inside the boundary and still receive farm use assessment. Under the bill, if it goes to a family member, which is defined farmer to farmer, then if as long as it keeps in family farming, it can continue the farm use assessment. If it goes to an insurance company or a developer or some other holding company, essentially, that isn't directly related and isn't engaged in agriculture, then the farm use assessment would be lost. The bill in front of you has been endorsed by the obviously the builders, but also the nurserymen, the Farm Bureau, Governor's Office, and the DLCD. It came out of the Senate unanimously. We would ask you to send it to the floor, do pass, and hope for the same treatment in the House. Be glad to take any questions.
Thank you, Representative Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, this is a great bill.
Thank you.
One of the best that you've ever testified on.
Clean living is the key, Representative Starr. Thank you very much.
And I only wish that we'd had this kind of opportunity on the books 10 years ago before all the farmland that is in the Tualatin Valley is now sprouting apartment buildings and high-tech companies.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Starr, thank you for the compliment. I'll defer most of it. It was a group effort that came up with the bill, and it was a lot of work. But Representative Starr makes a very good point, but if I may, one of the biggest issues facing Oregon land use, I believe, is the Woodburn example. Everybody that drives up and down the freeway sees development occurring on good farmland, which is inside an overgrowth boundary, and therefore, by law, isn't farmland anymore. It's available for development. It probably shouldn't have happened. And we have areas, as Representative Starr points out, in the Tualatin Basin and other places, where excellent Class 1 and 2 dirt is being built on, and instead we're protecting Class 4 and 5 dirt up on the hillsides as though it's good farmland. This bill, the approach taken by this bill is a start, I believe, towards getting a better balance and getting a little more sophisticated about our balancing of agriculture uses and development uses. And we're very pleased with the bill we're bringing forward.
Thank you for the questions. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chandler.
Representative Bowman, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well today, thank you. Mr. Chandler, I see no limit on the number of farms that can elect to separate themselves from the urban growth boundary. Would you care to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, there's a limit in a sense that the governing body has to allow it. And there's a set of standards in the bill looking at urban service provision. I don't have the, I just brought my testimony, but I don't have a copy of the bill in front of me. But a series of findings the local government would have to make, you know, whether deciding whether or not to allow that farmland to come out. It isn't simply the option of the farmer. The farmer asks for it, and the local government would have to evaluate that request in light of their long-range planning and whether or not that farmland coming out would foul up something else they were trying to accomplish. So there's...
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
I understand from your testimony, Mr. Chandler, that if I own a farm here and I get the exclusion, then my neighbor can ask for the exclusion based on the fact that I've been excluded, and so on and so forth and so forth. And so I see a potential of, you know, everybody stepping in line and saying, I'm next, me, and I don't see any prohibition in this bill to prevent that from happening.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, there is no prohibition, but let me offer in the bill, let me offer a couple practical ones. First one is that we're not talking about an unlimited supply of land. What we're talking about is land that is in current active agricultural production adjacent to or next property in from the boundary. So we're not talking about taking the take an entire swath, because at some point, if you were swathing, you would come to development, and then this would no longer be available. The second practical prohibition is that this will attract primarily those very hardcore farmers. Right? I don't mean that disparagingly, but people who really sincerely want to base their life on farming. You're taking land that, if in a metro area, for example, inside the boundary, would be worth $150,000 to $200,000 an acre, and dropping its value by taking it outside the boundary down to about $5,000 or maybe $10,000 an acre. And the number of folks who are going to be willing to take that kind of a asset hit, my guess is probably fairly small. I mean, it's not something that people, I don't think, are going to be jumping at. It is, however, a way to get Pendleton and LeGrand are two good examples, not the metro area. I don't really think this would affect much property in the metro area, the truth. In both Pendleton and LeGrand, there is good wheat land that's been included in the boundary, because when they drew the lines in the first place, we weren't really thinking about that. Now that we're more aware of, wait a second, this land here can do 70, 80 bushels an acre. This land over here can only do 40. Maybe we ought to be building on the 40, not the 70. That's where I think this is going to come into play, where local government and the agriculture community can work together to redraw these lines in a more scientific fashion.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion. Representative Beck.
So in the Woodburn situation, it's unlikely anybody would have opted to get out of the urban growth boundary. As good as the farmland is, they'd rather they could make more money building
strip malls.
Well, what they call them, retail malls, whole wholesale malls. Is that right? I mean, your example really isn't.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, I wasn't. The example is simply one of the point I'm trying to make with the example is disconnects between what the public perception of Oregon's land use, the purpose of Oregon land use system, and the actual on-the-ground effects of it. Woodburn, I use because people talk about it all the time in committees, and as I'm sure you're aware, Woodburn was an economic development project in the Goldschmidt administration and made an awful lot of sense at that point to try to revitalize the economy of that area.
Right.
The fact remains that we did, by making those economic development decisions, take farmland out of production. That had we been thinking about the farmland preservation issue and other more sophisticated land use techniques, probably would not have occurred. As to whether or not people in Woodburn would come out, I simply don't know. I think that's pure speculation one way or the other. It's sort of along the lines of Representative Bowman's question, where I answer that question. There will be some farmers who simply want to remain farming and will use this bill in order to do so. Some won't. Most won't.
Another question.
Go ahead.
So let's say Fuji Farms out in Troutdale wanted to sell to, Representative Sinceri, who wants to lead the legislature and farm raspberry.
Right. Absolutely.
When he wins the lottery and he wants to farm, under this bill, farm use assessment would no longer continue?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, that's correct.
Wow.
If I may, as a follow-up to that particular provision was, if I remember the discussions correctly, offered by the Farm Bureau as part of their recognition that the problem that we're protecting farmland inside the boundary that maybe wasn't supposed to be protected. And so deliberately, a Fuji farm is selling to Representative Sinceri unless he is related, and I'm not aware of the relationship. And if you do decide to go berry farming, talk to me. I'll try to talk you out of it. That would he'd have to make the decision on whether or not to do berry farming without the tax incentive.
Follow-up on same with Alpenrose. If the Alpenrose family wanted to sell to someone else who wanted, if they didn't want to go through the open space thing, which I guess they could through this bill, I want to ask about that too, but without the open space provision, if they want to sell to someone else who wants to run a ball field and a quasi-dairy farm, and they couldn't stay, they couldn't do that and retain the farm assessment.
Mr. Member, absolutely, they could not. I think what you're kind of getting into a separate area, which is the issue of the economics of agriculture and the farm use assessment as it relates thereto. The Alpenrose situation, the income off of Alpenrose is from that property itself. The income derived from that property is hot dogs and snow cones,
right,
far more than it is
right
dairy cows. And so I would presume that anybody purchasing that for the purpose of continuing the go-karts and the baseball operation would be basing their financial analysis on that, not the farm use assessment.
But
we did put the open space piece in there specifically to address those kinds of properties.
So if I can follow up back to the Fuji example, if Fuji wanted to sell and to someone who wanted to keep farming, they could place the open space overlay over it and retain the effective equivalent of the farmland assessment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, quite so. One of the discussion points that took place within the group that was working on this bill was on the is there a way to make farming permanent, for folks that simply do not want to convert? And the reality is that most people who are engaged in agriculture within urban growth boundaries are doing so until they sell. I mean, it is not often, most of the time, it's not with the intention of continuing that use ad infinitum. I mean, for one thing, the development pressures are too great, the kids may not want to farm, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But trying to balance that issue, and that's why I went with the open space idea, because you did lock it in for a period of time without making it permanent. A Fuji or someone in that situation, if they didn't join the boundary, and if they did, they could use the first part of the bill to try to come out. But not everybody who's in that position is going to want to come out permanently. That's a fairly drastic
right
step. The 20-year open space made more sense from the farming standpoint as well as the development standpoint. Our interest in all of this was to make sure that land that was available for development really was in fact available for development and wasn't going to be off limits. In those 10,000 acres in the Portland area that I mentioned, most of those will convert from farm use to urban. Some won't. And to that extent, the calculations of what's available for building in the Portland area is off by whatever that factor is of land that isn't going to convert out of agricultural use. That's our concern. This bill tries to strike the balance between the interest of, you know, from the development side, know what we have available as an inventory to build on, and from the agriculture side to make sure they continue some degree of viable operations without just losing it altogether.
The open space assessment, now that is, people can get open space assessment on their plan now under state law if it meets certain criteria, I believe.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, I would take a quiz on the open space law. I was kind of hoping you knew it better than I did. I believe you're right. The bill builds on that, though, and sets up a process similar to these coming out of the boundary equation where the local government would have the ability to look at the application and say, and make a determination, does it going to foul up our infrastructure delivery? Is it going to make a, are other plans going to be affected by this and so on and so forth? It would, again, it wouldn't be automatic. It would be the local government making the decision in light of everything else that they were concerned with. If I may, Mr. on that same related point, one of the concerns that was brought up and the reason we didn't bring the bill forward in 97 was the potential fiscal impact on local government, because once land inside the urban service area converts out without the tax recapture, it does come up to a higher use valuation, so there'd be some gain to the local government, but they would lose the taxes they would otherwise have received. I'm not sure if any of the local government people have signed up to testify on the bill, but we did make it clear in the legislation that it's a may. The local government does not have to do this. And presumably, they would take the tax implications of that action into account when they decided whether or not to proceed with that urban service area designation and the consequent forgiveness of the recapture.
Oh, well, that's important. They may forgive the deferred taxes. They aren't required to forgive them.
Look, Mr. Chairman, what they may do is decide whether or not to designate an area within the urban growth boundary as the area of future urban, pursuant to the bill, having a capital improvement plan and all of that. Once that is done, once that discretionary step is taken, then the tax forgiveness follows. They don't have to do that first step. And the discussion we had at the committee level was essentially to make sure that they didn't, that no local government would be put in a position of having to forego this revenue. They could. Mm-hmm. This is a tool that they might be able to use. They may, nobody may use this. For those that do, we would expect that tax loss in the short term would be taken into account in making the decision to adopt the planning process as identified by the bill.
And one or two more. On the open space assessment, would those deferred tax, you presumably receive a tax deferral or lower tax rate on open space, those be deferred, or would they have to pay those upon conversion from open space to developable land under this bill? Because right now, I think under the open space provisions, once you go out of open space, if you were county approved an open space overlay and you had your tax reduced, when you change, you are required, there's a formula, 10 years of back taxes or something.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, best of my recollection, if they, again, I'm not familiar with open space statute, if there's a formula, it isn't affected by the bill. So whatever the sets up a different, in addition to the process for coming into open space designation, doesn't do anything with whatever happens once you're there or when it's expired and you come out. So
it doesn't deal with the recapture.
No.
Of property taxes on if someone opts for the open space.
I don't believe so. Again, I don't have the bill in front of me. I don't recall that happening.
Okay.
Representative Starr.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chandler. Let's talk about the metro area for a second. Let's say that metro goes hog wild and extends urban growth boundary significantly onto farmland. This would.
the gavel, Mr. Chairman.
provided that Lubin was, that was approved and that urban growth boundary was moved, and that this would provide an option for farmers that were inside that area to appeal to say, hey, we'd rather continue to farm.
Mr. Chairman, members, sorry, that's absolutely correct. The point of Oregon's land use system from the get-go was to preserve farm and forest land, and we've done a pretty fair job of it. We haven't always been successful. We're now understanding that there's more to it than just that. You have to balance the development needs and infrastructure delivery and urban form and all of that. It was our feeling of this group that this bill provided a tool that could be used exactly for that circumstance. If the local government added farmland or had farmland in it, it could come out in favor of land elsewhere that wasn't as productive agriculturally. That's would make, if, as long as it's, from our standpoint and from the local government standpoint, if it's buildable and you can accommodate the growth you're expecting, and you can save farmland at the same time, that's the way it's supposed to work.
Any further? All right. Thank you.
Thank you,
John. Appreciate that. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 586, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 586.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkinson.
I'll move Senate Bill 586 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Atkinson moves Senate Bill 586 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do we have any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck and Representative Beck.
I'm going to vote cautiously no today. I'm going to talk to Mr. Chandler some more about this. May change my vote. He and I have talked about farms inside urban growth boundaries in the past, and I'm certainly one to try to incent farmers to try to move toward development in order to preserve farmland outside urban growth boundaries in my community. But I am concerned about change of no longer requiring farmers to pay back taxes. I think the public has been providing a benefit to incent farmland, and as long as that stays farmland, I think that's worth the public interest to have deferred taxes. But when the land becomes ready, when the owner becomes ready to reap an immense benefit and by selling their property, I think the very least they can do is send some of those deferred property taxes back to the local community. So that's a big concern I have, unless I'm missing the bill, but I'm open to talking some more with Mr. Chandler.
Right. Thank you. Noted, Representative Beck. Representative Bowman, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I think Representative Beck kind of read my mind. I think I get a little nervous when the Farm Bureau, the building industry, and DLCB and the governor all agree on something. I tend to think that there's something else that needs to be addressed in this bill. I think my biggest concern about this bill is the unlimited potential for removing folks out of the urban growth boundary, and I need to do some checking before I will be comfortable in supporting this bill. So today I'll be a no vote as well.
Right, thank you. Representative Sunseri.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm unclear about some of the taxing situations here, too, and I will vote no today, but I may vote yes on the floor, but I may have missed it, but if farmers are going to be able to remain farming and within the urban growth boundary, but yet not have a tax deferral, I don't know how they're going to run their operations.
No, that's from.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Maybe I confused you. They would retain their tax deferral while they're farming. Under current law, when they sell their land,
they pay it back.
They pay it back, and this would remove the requirement that they would pay those deferred taxes back. I'm looking for a nodding head. So that's a big change. So if your property, you've been paying virtually nothing for your property taxes, and you bought the property 50 years ago for $10 an acre, it's now worth $200,000 an acre, and we've been subsidizing, incenting farmland and encouraging farmland, but now that you're ready to sell it and make a lot of money on it, we're not even asking for a portion of the deferred property taxes back. If any of us a concern about that.
Thank you. Representative Sinceri, did that help, or do we want to pull Mr. Chandler back up?
Well, Mr. Chair, go ahead and vote. I think I will vote no on this now, but reserve the right to vote yes on the floor.
Okay. All right, we have a motion currently made by Representative Atkinson, and do we have any further discussion? All right, clerk, call it.
Vincent?
Aye.
Deck?
No.
Goldman?
No.
Decker?
Yes.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Let's go.
Thompson? Wilson?
Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Starr, would you carry that one too, please?
Yes.
Thank you. Close the work session on Senate Bill 586. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 198. And Kara, would you speak to that one too, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Member, Senate Bill 198 is requested by the Oregon Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, who I believe is here to explain the bill today. It has to do with bonding and local government and all kinds of fun, interesting stuff.
All right, thank you. And testifying will be Jim Shannon. Mr. Shannon, welcome, and would you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Jim Shannon. I'm a bond attorney from Portland, and I'm also the chair of the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. The committee staff is handing out my testimony now, and on the first page of that, I've kind of given a synopsis of the MDAC, or the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. It's a legislative commission, or a commission appointed by the legislature, and its primary function is to assist local governments with their debt issuance and management practices. For the past 8 or 9 years, the commission has held hearings with the members of the public and local government officials and public finance professionals, and asked them for input as to what we can do, as the commission can do, in presenting to the legislature legislative changes that will assist local governments with their debt issuance and management practices. Senate Bill 198 is the result of those public hearings and the comments that or concepts that were approved by the commission. Primarily, they are technical amendments to the public finance laws that whose primary focus is to lower the borrowing costs of local governments and to make their debt management practices more efficient. I'd be glad to go through each one of those if you'd like, or answer your questions, whichever you prefer. As an additional handout with my testimony, I have included a copy of Senate Bill 199 and some testimony regarding Senate Bill 199. Senate Bill 199 was also approved by the House or the Senate General Government Committee and was passed to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation, but from the Senate floor it was referred to the Revenue Committee for some revenue analysis and then was never heard again from because it was so late in the in your timing, so it was not did not get a hearing at the Revenue Committee, and it in fact died. We would like to ask this committee to consider adding the provisions of Senate Bill 199 to the Senate Bill 198 because they have there are concepts in there which have a direct benefit to local government. The final handout in my packet is a release from Moody's Investors Corporation relating to a financing that Multnomah County just priced in April. You'll notice that Moody's rated this financing AA3. Then if you go in the second full paragraph of their release, they comment that proposed legislation currently before the Oregon legislature, which is in fact Senate Bill 199, if approved, would have resulted in Moody's giving the county a better rating, namely AA2 on this financing, and it would also eliminate the need for a reserve fund and a security interest in the property. So the public market recognizes the benefits of 199, specifically to counties, and this would have, had it been in place, would have lowered the county's borrowing costs with this particular financing. Given that, and I know you are, as the committee administrator mentioned, bond law is something that's very arcane in many cases and very discreet. I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have regarding any part of Senate Bill 198, 199, or my testimony.
Thank you. We have amendments that are on the way, but not here yet, so feel free to take a moment to ask any questions you might have. Representative Sachs?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about Section 4. Paragraph 3B, you change, you eliminate the word building and you include the word improvement. I don't see a definition of improvement. Is improvement defined somewhere in ORS that this is referring to?
Mr. Chair, Senator, or Representative Starr, no, there is no definition specifically in this section for improvement. Other than improvements we had in there to real property, which was, for some reason, at the Senate side, taken out. And we couldn't figure out why. But in any event, the idea here, this is under the local option tax section, and the way the current law it reads is if, in fact, a local government chooses to go to the voters and the voters approve a local option tax for a capital project, it's limited to a building. And we had a number of local governments that said we'd like to build a swimming pool, or maybe we would like to build a play structure, or a parking lot, or put pipes underground, water or sewer pipes underground, and it would not be allowed under current law for the local option levy. That's why we changed the verbiage to an improvement, and which would include.
Another question?
Yes, go ahead.
In Section 5, can you talk about the addition of the language there? Does this have anything to do, or does this play into the limitations that were adopted by the voters in Measure 50, how the rate covenants and all that. Can you explain that?
Yeah, Chairman Wilson, Representative Starr, no, it has nothing to do with Measure 50. This involves, section involves revenue financings, typically a water or sewer system where you finance capital improvements and you pledge your water or sewer revenues, and the marketplace requires that you agree to a rate covenant, namely that your revenues will equal or exceed 100 to 150% of your maintenance and operational costs and your debt service. We have, over the past few years, issued those types of bonds with a rate covenant, but we couldn't find, quite frankly, any specific statutory authority for a rate covenant. It was more in the general authority. So this was a request by bond lawyers, not myself, but other bond lawyers in the state, to give them comfort when a municipality makes a rate covenant.
Perfect. That clarifies that. I do have a concern about the fact that improvement in the other section is not defined. I think that's a pretty broad universe. Mm-hmm.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has to do with the payment of interest on the bonds for off-street motor vehicle parking facilities. Would you care to share what that whole motor vehicle parking structure section means?
Yes, Chair Wilson, Representative Bowman. This is specific statutory language available only to cities, and it authorizes cities to issue obligations for parking facilities. City of Portland has found, based upon the provisions of the current law, they have two types of parking facilities, on-street metered and off-street parking structures. And the way that the current law is written and the way the marketplace has been structured, they would like to have the ability to only pledge the revenues from their off-street parking facilities, namely the parking structures, to their financing. But there is no distinction in the current law between off-street and on-street, only parking facilities. And so they have indicated to the commission that that requires them to pledge not only their parking facilities revenues, but also their meter revenues. And they would like to be able to do something separate with their meter revenues. And so that's why this Section 3 delineates between off-street and other parking facilities.
If I may follow up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair, is that a unique problem to the City of Portland, or is that an issue in other parts of the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, I think it would be similar to any community that has the density needed for parking structures. In other words, if you have a parking structure in Lebanon, for example, that is a municipally owned revenue producing, you may want to finance those parking structures only with the revenues generated from those off-street parking structures and not impinge upon your on-street or meter revenue. I mean, yeah, this does not prohibit you from commingling if you choose to do so, but it allows you to separate them also if it it makes more financial advantage for you to do that.
Yes, Mr. Chair. It was my understanding that most of the off-street parking is privately owned in the city of Portland, so I'm not quite sure what we're trying to separate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, this involves municipally owned parking structures. The ones that come to mind to me are the arena parking structures are municipally owned. One of them is, I believe. And so the revenues from that are pledged to some of the infrastructure bonds that the city of Portland issued when the arena was initially constructed. But the privately owned off-street parking structures are not in any way affected by this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? All right, thanks very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 198. We'll have some amendments coming to put 199 into it, prospectively so. So we will bring this back another time. All right, we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 193. And while we're waiting for our sign-up list here, Kara, if you would talk to that bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 193 comes at the request of the State Treasury and does various and sundry things, including allowing the State Treasurer to record monies paid to the Treasury rather than issuing a receipt, an actual hard copy receipt for the money they received. I believe it's intended to cover electronic transfers. The State Treasury will tell us.
All right, thank you.
Most of it does.
Darren Bond.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the State Treasury. And yes, this Senate Bill 193 is our housekeeping bill and covers various and sundry technical pieces of statute that have, they're no longer reflective of the way we do business today. Sections 1 and 2 eliminates references to receipts. In the 10 years I've been in Treasury, we've never given a receipt. We provide electronic records, usually paper records sometimes, but we don't write anybody receipts. Section 3 modifies definitions in ORS 295, the public funds collateralization statutes. The first modification is a grammatical change inserted by Ledge Council. The second change is more substantive. It impacts the definition of investments as it pertains to collateralization of public funds. What it does is gives us some idea of the timing of an investment. For us at Treasury, given the various kinds of investment activity we have, sometimes it's difficult under this definition to know exactly when monies were moving to an investment provider under an investment contract meets this qualification of investment. This clarifies that at the time of the transfer, then these monies are considered invested. There's a deletion in 295.0057F that just clears up an oversight. It references a statute that has previously been repealed. And the deletions, the repeals in Section 4 of the bill are obsolete. They no longer reflect the business that transpires between the Department of Administrative Services and Treasury relative to various records and documents. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I can go through those records in detail if you like.
Thank you. Representative Harper.
Chair, so Mr. Bond, Treasury has been breaking the law for 10 years. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harper, I guess technically that could be the case. Talking to the Attorney General's office, an argument can be made that the records that we provide are receipts. But as we detected this, I was uncomfortable with that, and so elected to clarify that. We do provide, for every transaction that happens at Treasury from a state agency or a local government, they get a document either electronically or on paper that says exactly what that transaction was and how it impacted their account. Furthermore,
technically, you're not going to jail.
Mr. Chair, Representative Harper, technically, I hope not.
Any further questions?
Theoretically.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 193, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 193. Representative Bowman?
Senate Bill, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 193 to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman moves Senate Bill 193 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do we have any discussion? Seeing none, we'll ask the clerk to call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck? Bowman?
Yes.
Decker? Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
No.
Sunseri?
Aye.
Thompson? Wilson?
Aye. And the motion carries. And Representative Atkinson, would you carry that?
Certainly.
Thank you. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 193. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 194. And Karen, please.
Chair members, this is another Treasury bill. It establishes the maximum administrative charges that the Treasurer can impose as an investment officer for investing specified public funds. Mr. Bond is back.
All right, welcome back, and if you'd identify yourself again, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, again, I'm Darren Vaughn, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. Senate Bill 194 clarifies language in ORS Chapters 293 and 294 to allow the Treasury to charge for services based on an established fee structure rather than the process we currently have in place, which is a pro rata distribution of expenses that have been incurred. It also allows us to charge local government customers similar to how we charge state agencies with a mix of transaction fees and administrative fee charged on invested assets. And it also allows us to charge a higher administrative fee for the investments of monies in the Oregon Short-Term Fund. Senate Bill 194 doesn't result in any additional charges or revenue to the state treasury. What it does is it results in a reallocation of who pays the fees for what we do. Currently, Treasury determines expenses for a period of time, and then we bill back over that period of time. Retroactively, we bill the state agencies for those costs incurred. The process now is based on limited number of transactions, namely deposits and checks that the agencies write, and we use that as our rule of thumb to charge them back. What this will allow us to do is to establish a fee structure, publish it. It's a forward-looking fee structure as opposed to backwards-looking. It'll allow us to create a more comprehensive set of fees, thereby allowing agencies to know, they know what kind of services they use. They'll know what their costs are going to be for the periods of time ahead of them, given their transaction volumes. It'll allow us to more equitably distribute our costs to the state agencies that use the services we provide. Additionally, Treasury is prohibited from charging local governments transaction fees. The only way we recover costs from local governments is through our administrative fee. We're asking to be able to charge local governments on a transaction fee, again, for services they provide, to put a little user fee aspect into the way we charge local governments. Again, it will result in a more equitable distribution of our costs, our charges to local governments. Right now, if I have a local government that has a $10 million, an account with a $10 million balance that transacts one ACH transaction a month with me, and I have a local government that has a $10 million balance that has five or six transactions a week or a day, those two customers are going to pay the exact same amount. My costs are different for those, and they should pay a different amount. And this will allow us to do that. This will allow us to create a mix of fees that will most equitably distribute the cost across the participants. The local governments are aware of this. We've been discussing this with local governments for about a year and a half, I guess, now. It does redistribute costs somewhat. The high volume transaction users of Treasury are going to pay an incrementally higher fee with local governments. But the Harry Morton, the treasurer from Multnomah County, who will be impacted negatively by this. Multnomah County will pay somewhat more in fees, but Harry said that, you know, recognizes that he should pay a higher amount of fees given the pool. It's hard to argue with equity when we're distributing our costs back, so. The other significant change is a change in the maximum administrative fee that we would be able to charge against our, against the money we manage in the Oregon Short-Term Fund, which is the working capital of the state. It's the cash pool that we have, as opposed to the dedicated funds for PERS and SAFE and VETS portfolios. Currently, we're allowed to charge 0.25 basis points monthly. Treasury used to charge based on income earned. In 1995, the legislature determined that that was the revenue stream from an income earned approach was quite volatile. So the legislature determined that an administrative fee charge, which is the industry standard in the investment world, was a more appropriate method. And we've done that, and the 0.25 basis points is quite adequate and has been quite adequate to fund our activity and is today. What's changed is that since then we have learned to budget more discreetly. We budget better. We have put in place a more systematic and rational cost allocation process that where we can identify our expenses to our programs better. And what we've seen is the Oregon Short-Term Fund has various administrative costs that are greater than other aspects of our investment activity. And by identifying that, to be able to rectify that and charge for those to the users of the Oregon Short-Term Fund, the currently right now would put me right at the very right at that cap, about 0.2402 or something like that. On a go-forward basis, it's not tenable for us to live right at the maximum for a number of reasons. One is right now the Oregon Short-Term Fund has historically high deposits in it. We're about $6.25 billion. Our historical average is about $5 billion. Right now, we also have had an environment of stable and fairly low interest rates, which we don't expect to continue for the unforeseeable or forever here. And so should we move back towards those historic norms, or should we see a situation where the interest rates change suddenly, and in this environment that would be a rate movement up, then what we tend to see in that environment, we saw it in 1994, is a rapid movement of the discretionary funds in the Oregon Short-Term Fund, namely local government money and trust fund monies, running to higher earning short-term investments. Again, that will throw our balances significantly below the amount that would be needed to pay the bills of the Oregon Short-Term Fund in this different proposed strategy. I could go through the various changes in the bill section by section. That covers all of my testimony, the summary of my testimony.
Yeah, let me ask our committee members. Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about section 2, line 21. You add the words a maximum of 0.25 basis points, and then line you have, however, for funds dispatched under OS 293.701, 20. Can you explain what that means? Funds that are in the hands of the state treasurer that are not required to meet the current demands. Can you understand what that, explain what that means?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, that's 293.701.20 is that legislation that created the excess funds, which we have in the Oregon Short-Term Fund. That's where it is in statute. That's, if you look at the statute, there's all the various dedicated funds that the legislature has described over the years, and there's those other funds that we have, and that falls within that realm right there.
So that's the Oregon Short-Term Fund?
Right.
That is the reference to the Oregon Short-Term
Fund. So the rest of these, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you. The rest of these funds, all you have the 2.25 basis points.
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, that's correct. Of the $42 billion portfolio at Treasury, this would impact approximately $50 billion of that.
Representative Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple of questions, Mr. Bond. Can the local governments opt out of using you
Mr. Chair, Representative Harper, the local investment pool is a completely voluntary program.
So they can go anyplace?
In fact, they're limited in how much they can use us because we have a higher than market rate yield on our portfolio. Therefore, I believe any competition.
They could use Merrill Lynch or Price or use anything. Okay. What are we talking about? How much money did you generate at 0.25, and how much will you generate at 0.5?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harper, the change relative to Durgan Short-Term Fund, I believe we're talking about $40,000. Keeping in mind that what that is I'll generate the same amount of money in this scenario. What we'll see is those other funds that Representative Starr alluded to will be charged an incrementally lower rate, and the Oregon Short-Term Fund will be charged an incrementally higher rate. Keeping in mind that these are only maximums, this isn't the amount that we charge. But the shift from those dedicated trust funds to the Oregon Short-Term Fund in this scenario amounts to approximately $40,000, I believe.
So you're doubling the fees for the short-term fund, and that will increase costs $40,000?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harper, I'm not proposing. What we're asking is to double the maximum that could be charged in the worst-case scenario if we had to pay ends meet. Right now, the Oregon Short-Term Fund would, in this scenario, pay a slightly less than the 0.25 basis points.
Yeah, how much is that over the last biennium, say, or whatever did that generate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harper, I can't tell you exactly. I'm sorry. The Oregon Short-Term Fund costs, the program costs associated with that are about $145,000 a month.
Currently.
Actually, that's the basis.
That's your
budget.
That's your program cost. That's
program
expenses.
Cost for the Oregon Short-Term Fund.
And how much do you realize in these fees? What's your profit?
We don't make a profit. I mean, our fees are based on recapturing costs. And while we do keep a minimum working capital balance, but that's which is I believe about.
So it costs the company $145,000 a month to administer this program.
Right.
Okay, and if we double the fees, what will that generate?
If I double the fees, it'll generate approximately $290,000.
But this bill does not double the fees.
What this bill does, Mr. Chair, if I may, bill does is it allows us, it increases the cap, which is the maximum that could be charged. But we don't charge. Again, we charge based on what our expenses are for managing these investments. And, for instance, right now in the portfolio as a whole, I believe we're charging 0.11 because the short-term fund now is embedded with all of that $42 billion investments, the dedicated funds and everything. And that is currently being charged about 0.11 basis points. And so what we're proposing is to take the short-term fund out, because I can identify, you know, those costs of that subset of the fund is different than it is for those other dedicated.
I understand. And that's 0.11 total. It's not for the short-term fund.
That currently is for the short-term fund
0.1
and everything else. If I take that short-term fund out, I can't pay for it at 0.11. I pay for it at about 0.24.
So 0.25 will meet expenses.
0.25 today meets expenses.
Okay, why do we need to increase?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harper, again, we're in an environment, I'm asking to increase the cap. And the reason we need to increase the cap is because the Oregon Short-Term Fund right now has historically high balances in it that we don't expect those to continue at those levels for the with nothing other than the fact that I just look back at how long we had historical norms of between $5 and $5.5 billion, and also recognizing that we've had a very stable interest rate environment And when rates turn against us, we have a lot of discretionary money in the short-term fund that runs. And when it runs, again, all the local government money is discretionary. A lot of the trust fund monies can move into other investments. And because that activity goes out, doesn't mean that our administrative costs go down. Whether you're, you know, investing a $2.5-3 billion pool in a $5 or $6 billion pool, the only real difference is the size of the blocks you trade. It isn't that we're doing less trading or have less customers, less administrative activity. We just have less money there to spread these costs over. So in that scenario, given breaking the Oregon short-term fund out, I wouldn't be able to cover those costs of the short-term fund for that period of time until things got back more to an even keel.
One more. I guess what I'm really trying to get at, Mr. Bond, is an unfunded mandate to the local governments. Well, how much are their costs going to increase? Yeah, I've heard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Harper, right now the local governments' costs won't increase at all. But right now for local governments, I'm charging local governments the maximum 0.25 basis points because local governments are in a separate.
Exactly, and we're about to authorize you to double that. How much will their cost increase?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harper, their costs, if we went to the cap, which this doesn't say, this doesn't authorize me to move to 0.5 basis points. It allows me to. But it doesn't tell me that I'm going to move, excuse me. What it doesn't say is that I will begin charging 0.5. It says that I can.
Mm-hmm.
We have to.
And worst, okay.
So if you authorize this, the local government costs don't change. If our costs went up so much that if we had to move to that maximum, which means you gave us some really phenomenal budgets over the next few years, then I guess potentially given the size of the pool now, the total cost increase to local governments would be about $75,000 a month.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess there's two separate questions that I have. One, let's go back to the change with local government. Currently, local government is being charged the same rate, the 0.25 rate, and everybody's being charged that regardless of the number of transactions per month, that's the set rate. Did I understand that much so far?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, that's correct.
Okay, good. So I'm doing so far so good. And with this bill, we will now charge based on the transaction versus a monthly rate. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, will charge based on both. There'll be a transaction fee component, and there will be a monthly administrative fee based on their balances component. Those two things combined will equal the expenses that we have to cover those costs.
Those two expenses combined, will they be more than the 0.25 base?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, no. Actually, in the Oregon Short-Term Fund as a whole, in the proposal that we see that dropping to about 0.24 basis points.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair, and so this legislation would allow you to go up to a 0.50 base.
Yes.
What economic activity would have to exist in order for you to raise that level to 0.50?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, we picked a number, a cap that we felt was sufficient to work with in the worst case scenario. But should we see something happen like happened in 1994, where the Fed rapidly increased rates, short-term interest rates ran up very high, we have a multi-billion-dollar portfolio that's pretty slow for us, you know, to move and follow that. So we lag the market. We saw $1.5 to $2 billion of local government money run out the door. And in that kind of an environment, if we're pushed down to about, you know, somewhere around $3.5 billion, and granted it would be for a short period of time, because we will eventually catch back up with the market and we'll surpass it. But through that period of time, it will probably take, it takes about 0.42 basis points to cover all the expenses of the pool, given this program structure that we're trying to put in place.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair, one more question.
I tell you what my intentions would be. If you want to ask this question, that's fine, but I detect a general sense of unease with the committee, and I would ultimately ask Mr. Bond to kind of make the rounds here in the next few days to catch us all up on this.
Okay, I'll hold my question.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you. All right, Mr. Bond, thank you. And as I mentioned, I think we'll go ahead and call this hearing to a close. And if you would kind of make the rounds
sure.
here, okay? I appreciate that
thank
very
you.
Much. Right. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 194. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 914. And Mark Landauer, red carriage, please.
Which other one?
Looks like Mr. Cross joins. All right. Hi, gentlemen. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. Thank you for holding this hearing on Senate Bill 914, which was introduced at the request of the City of Portland. I've asked Ray Carriage, who is our commercial inspection manager, and Bill Cross to join me today to go into greater detail why this bill is important to us and why we hope you will look favorably upon it and move it out of the committee today. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ray Carriage. Just a little word of explanation about this. This bill expands the scope of the work allowed under a master permit authorized in ORS 455190. So just a little word about what is a master permit. A master permit is a fast-tracking permitting system for interior work and maintenance within commercial, industrial, and government buildings. It's kind of like an annual umbrella permit, and it differs from a regular building permit in the following way. Under a master permit, you only need to take one of these out every year to cover all of your tenant improvement work and maintenance work within the facility. Unlike under the regular program, what you would have to do is you'd have to take out a separate permit, make separate applications for each of those projects under the normal program. It's master permits are voluntary programs, and they're available to property managers and developers, and the developer can enroll anyone of their facilities or buildings for $100 per building. As I say, the work is limited to very, very minor work. And because it's limited to this minor scope of work, it's possible to be very, very creative in some of the features and programs that we put together. I've listed some stuff in my testimony about what the City of Portland's programs can do. And very, very quickly, what it does is it cuts down the time it takes to get a permit. It means the contractors can start work very, very quickly. One inspection team is assigned to do the plan review and inspection on the facility, so you're dealing with the same people through the permit review process and the inspection. It contains the cost through an hourly billing system. All of this, and there is no reduction in the level of public safety in the buildings. The original master permit concept came up in the 1993 legislature. With FOMA, asked for the bill to be built so that we could introduce some kind of innovative and creative ways of dealing with building inspections and building permits. The statute that emerged was very, very broad. It gave us a lot of flexibility and the ability to create some new programs. But unfortunately, when we got into the rulemaking, because nobody really had a good idea about how a master permit program would be developed, the rules that came out were very, very restrictive, and we ended up with a program with a kind of limited scope and a lot of very, very tight rules. The kinds of rules that were put in place, and as I say, it's understandable why, because in those days, nobody knew what a master permit program could do. There are no other master permit programs in the United States other than right now the City of Phoenix has a program which is very, very similar. But the kinds of restrictions that were put on were that you couldn't do any tenant remodeling which exceeded 25% of any floor. Well, as you know, when a customer moves into a commercial building, they may want to renovate the whole floor or 30% of the floor. So the figure of 25% is a very, very restriction, very, very big restriction on this program. You couldn't do any load-bearing work, or you couldn't alter any load-bearing members under the program. You couldn't change occupancy. You couldn't do any accessibility or ADA retrofits under the program. And lastly, you couldn't change any passageways or exit routes. These, it puts a number of restrictions on the our ability to use this program. And as these restrictions were arbitrary, say they were based on the best people's best guess at that particular time, but now we've been running our program for about a year, and we had a number of customers involved in the program, and the feedback we get from them is they love this program, they would like to see, they would like to be able to deal with all of their interior tenant remodeling needs through this program. But unfortunately, they cannot because of the rules or the restrictive rules that are in place at this particular time. So what does Senate Bill 914 do? 914 redefines the term new construction as it is in the statute, and it expands the scope of what can be included in the program. The other thing this would do, Senate Bill 914, it gives a clear direction when we go back to rulemaking. It'll give a clear direction from the legislature as to how you guys want these rules to come out for the future. When we went through the Senate, Building Codes Division had some reservations about the program, and we've since had some discussions with them, and they have asked us to put together some to include some amendments in the in this bill. And I can take you through them real quickly. These are the amendments here. And there are three amendments, basically.
Dash one
amendment.
I just have the dash ones here.
That is correct.
That is it.
That's it.
That's
okay.
It, yes.
Thank you.
And if it'll help, I'll go through them really quickly.
Yes, if you would, please. Yes.
Lines 1 to 5, in essence, requires building officials to make a determination, probably in writing, before taking on a change of use in the master permit program. What that means is they have to do a determination, don't just accept it into the program, but do a review before they take it into the program. Between line 7 and lines 11, what this does, it requires municipalities who want to take on this program to have an engineer on staff. And the reason for that is because when you expand the scope of the program as outlined in Senate Bill 914, it does mean that you can do structural upgrades under this program, and it only makes sense to us and Building Codes Division that you have an engineer on staff who is capable of checking out those calculations. And the third amendment, which is from line 14 and 15, requires a municipality to have had a master permit program delegated to them before they start work under a master permit. And those are basically the amendments as I understand them. My last comment is that Senate Bill 914 has overwhelming support from our customers. And if you look into the back of the package, we have letters ranging here from contractors, from developers, from property owners. All of them are avid supporters and fans of this program. And they would like this program to be expanded. And so do we, by the way. Anyway, I would urge you to pass Senate Bill 914, and if you have any questions for me, I'd be more than happy to answer them if I can.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Carriage?
Representative
Coleman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a lot of handwritten notes on your dash one? Because what you were reading, I couldn't follow it with my dash one amendment.
Chair Wilson, Representative Owen, I made the notes on this to make sure that I understood them. But they're just kind of notes for clarifying, condensing the language into something that I can understand so I could hopefully explain that to you. Would you like me to go through them again?
No. Okay. No, that's fine. I guess my question is your goal is to expand this program statewide that has been a pilot project in the city of Portland?
Yes, it's been a pilot project in the city of Portland, and if approved, this would be available statewide.
And so if you bought a permit that was good for a year, would it be good outside of the city of Portland?
No, Representative Bowman, no, it wouldn't. It would only be valid within the jurisdiction that has the program.
Okay, thank you. That answers my question.
Any further questions?
Yes, my
question. All right. Mr. Landau? Mr. Cross.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I am here representing BOMA, the Building Owners and Managers Association of the Portland Metro Area, and we're here to support the bill. and the amendments and urge your adoption. It is a good program, and we would like to see it expanded to incorporate the kind of tenant improvements that oftentimes are more expansive than what's allowed in the current program.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Cross? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And Joe Brewer, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator of the Building Codes Division. I just want to say that the department is neutral on the bill, and we appreciate the fact that the City of Portland was willing to work with us and address our concerns and get us to a point where the bill is something that we think is necessary. A good example of streamlining some of the red tape and regulation that you've heard of in some other testimony, and we applaud the City of Portland's efforts and think it's a good program.
Thank you. Could you tell me what some of your concerns might have been? We've got just a couple of minutes, but I'd be interested in knowing what those were, how they were met.
Mr. Chairman, our concerns were mainly that programs that were sufficiently developed, large enough, take on this responsibility, not necessarily programs that might have, for instance, only a building official or only a building official and one inspector, not be deep enough in terms of the resource to be able to understand what they were getting into and what a master permit program required and entailed. And the City of Portland, I believe, concurred with those concerns. So we were trying to put a little tighter circle around how you qualify for this particular activity. Another one of the concerns we expressed on the Senate side, and I don't want to say anything to deter this bill moving forward, but we have this capability, this authority, and administrative rule already. So we were willing to address the City of Portland's concerns. But again, we think this bill in its current form is something that deserves support and should move forward.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask a quick question.
Representative Bowman.
How does this bill impact small contractors?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, this bill will make it possible for small contractors, subcontractors, to get their work started sooner, to avoid delays, deal with the same team of inspectors and reviewers throughout a project. So in that sense, I think it'll bring continuity and some ability to move forward more quickly for contractors that are working on tenant improvement projects, things of that nature.
I'm not satisfied, but I'll ask someone else. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Are we in work session, Mr. Chair?
No, we're not yet. Any further discussion? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 914, and we'll open work session on Senate Bill 914.
Mr. Chair.
Ooh.
Representative Starr.
I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 914.
Representative Starr moves the dash one amendment into Senate Bill 914. Is there any discussion? Any objections? All right. And dash one's carried.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
Move Senate Bill 914 as amended to the floor to the pass recommendation.
Representative Starr moves Senate Bill 914 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
I'm still not comfortable with this bill as of yet, so I'm going to be a no vote right now. My concern mainly is the testimony we've heard from small contractors say that they work in a variety of cities, and for them to buy a permit in one city that's good for a year may or may not have a negative impact on their ability to do the other jobs. So I need to talk to some other people, but today I'll be a no vote.
Noted. Thank you. All right, clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
Aye.
Bowman?
No.
Deckert?
Aye.
Harper? Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Aye.
Thompson? Wilson?
Aye. And the motion carries, and anybody want to carry that one? Okay, Representative Starr will be the carrier. Thank you, Representative, for your help in all the carrying today. All right, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 914, and with no further business, the committee is adjourned.